In the mountains outside Santa Cruz, California, three young filmmakers and their friends are creating a unique community. In addition to organic vegetables and goat's milk, they're producing what some have called mind-blowing digital animation. This group of 21st century pioneers has a do-it-yourself approach to just about everything it does. John Kalish reports on the utopian outpost known as Trout Gulch.
A lot of young people go home and live with their parents after college, but few transform the old homestead, quite like Isaiah Saxon. Saxon and two of his filmmaking buddies have started a small organic farm on 10 hilly acres that include his mother's house here in Aptos, California. They've built tiny houses for themselves and some friends, but more than that, they've transformed this land into a rural hackerspace of sorts.
We're building a 21st century hobbit village in which things are integrated into nature, but we're harnessing cutting-edge technology and embracing the best of technology.
Describing this place as a hobbit village isn't that far off the mark. Walk through a stand of redwood trees and up a steep hill, and you'll find a small grass hut with a 4-foot door. It looks like a hobbit might live inside. But it turns out that this is the home of a tall 33-year-old filmmaker named Darren Rabinovich.
This is basically a sleeping chamber that is built to last about 10 years and then decay beautifully back into the land and become mulch.
Outside his grass hut, there's a solar panel Rabinovich installed to power some lights and his laptop. It's a reminder that the bucolic and the space age coexist here at Trout Gulch. These wooded hills may seem like an unlikely setting for a digital animation company, but that's exactly what this back-to-the-land threesome has headquartered here. The company is called Encyclopedia Pictura. Here's a commercial it made for the video game Spore.
How will it be when you can choose what you turn into? Time to grow. What kind of creature are you?
Encyclopedia Pictura also makes music videos. It won major awards for a video it produced for the Icelandic musician Björk. These young digital animators are in such demand now that the budgets they command allow them to hire a small army of computer technicians at a film studio in Berkeley. Still, their office here at Trout Gulch consists of little more than three work tables with laptops on them.
We're constantly being asked to do ads.
Filmmaker Isaiah Saxon.
Everyone from Sprite to Jeep and Honda has asked us to do advertisements. We'll only do advertisements for products that we use. We could certainly be maximizing our potential to make money right now, but that would hinder and slow down the development of this neighborhood that we're building and would take us on a road to possibly a empty existence.
For Saxon and the other homesteaders here, a meaningful existence is one committed to sustainable architecture and agriculture. They use composting toilets and take turns milking the goats. And the big money they earn from commercial animation projects allows them to spend long periods of time building tiny houses in their utopian village here at Trout Gulch. Much of that life is lived in an outdoor kitchen with a homemade igloo-shaped oven situated just a few paces from the garden.
You're smelling an herb chicken. All of the herbs in this chicken dish are herbs that are less than 6 feet away from us, actually.
A commercial freezer discarded by a neighbor was hacked to serve as a very efficient refrigerator, thanks to information from the online community of home beer brewers. Filmmaker Sean Helfrich.
I would say I probably spend at least 50% of my time on the internet reading forums, and not just for fun, like trying to solve problems. So being able to hop on a forum and connect with someone or search the stored history of that forum is really key.
Helfrich learned online about installing small engines on bicycles to make it up the steep hill. A number of prominent figures in the do-it-yourself movement have come here to help build Trout Gulch. And friends of the three filmmakers in the Bay Area, mostly people in their 20s and 30s, volunteer for work crews and feel that they're a part of this place. Isaiah Saxon.
We're providing an opportunity for people to gain land-based experiences and do things on a larger scale than you could ever do inside a city with all of the legal and physical space constraints of a city. I think people are excited at the freedom of this place and the amazing sense of empowerment you get from being able to build everything around you.
The idea of building everything around you is one that the filmmakers at Trout Gulch are also exploring in a new entertainment and education medium called augmented reality. In it, a real-time view of the surrounding environment becomes digitally manipulable and interactive with programmed content. It's like walking through a video game taking place in the real world.
What you have is essentially magic.
But Saxon says augmented reality will be used for a lot more than games.
We see this as sort of the big new creative medium for the 21st century. And what we're trying to position ourselves as is the first creative team that really understands the intrinsic power of augmented reality and creates really memorable experiences and content for that. And we love to think of ourselves as trying to be the Walt Disney of augmented reality.
The filmmakers at Trout Gulch have more creative projects in the pipeline. They're working on a feature film about a bunch of kids who lead a DIY rebuilding effort after their town is devastated by a flood. For NPR News, I'm John Kalish.
You can find examples of Encyclopedia Pictura's work, including the music video they made for Bjork, on our website, npr.org. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer. NPR national political correspondent Don Gagne spent a couple of days in Pennsylvania talking to voters about the wrangling over the debt ceiling. He found a lot of frustration with Washington. He heard a lot of calls for both sides to work together, but little agreement on how.
In this story, we'll hear from two of the Pennsylvania voters I talked to this week. They were at Bucks County Community College in the town of Perkasie. It's about an hour north of Philadelphia. One of the people I met there, 57-year-old Ken Reynolds, saw the factory job he'd had for 26 years eliminated 3 years ago. He's juggled minimum wage jobs since. Another 20-year-old Angela DiValentino just started a new job in nursing. They don't know one another. I asked them about the impasse in Washington. First, DiValentino.
I just catch bits and pieces. I can't watch it because it's so annoying. It's just aggravating.
It was much the same from Reynolds.
Neither one of them seems to want to give because they're afraid that they're going to lose something out of it.
Both talked about what they see as a blame game where gaining political advantage seems more important than working together. Each also said the federal budget can be cut, that there's far too much wasteful spending and too much money spent for little benefit they can see. Each, on their own, cited foreign aid as a place ripe for deep cutting.
Why don't we pull out of other countries a little bit? Why are we making all their problems our problems? It's only causing more debt to us and more borrowing that we're doing.
DiValentino is a Republican. Reynolds, a Libertarian.
We constantly throw millions upon billions of dollars to outsiders, screaming, hey, come help us, but they're not helping us at all. I don't see it.
On the surface, the two seem pretty much in sync. I asked her about the president's insistence that deficit reduction also include revenue increases, including ending Bush-era tax cuts that benefit the wealthiest Americans. Her response is strong.
Is that fair to someone who got an education, went to school, got a good job, kept their good job, kept getting raises, and what, now they have to pay more because they work so hard? Why doesn't everyone get off their lazy butts and go get a job? That's what I'm sick of. I'm sick of the lazy people wanting to live off of everyone.
Reynolds looked on as I finished up the interview with DiValentino and as she said goodbye and headed outside. When I continued with him, he said he didn't vote for the president, but on this point, he thinks he's on the right track.
This girl's talking like, oh, we shouldn't worry about taxing the rich people. The rich people are bending and using the rules to their use, and other people are getting hurt down the line. I'm one of those people, all right? You can't say that I was a bad person when you put in 26 years and now we don't need you no more?
Reynolds said he wants to see the deficit cut, but he doesn't want it to come at the expense of people like him who are victims of a bad economy. And he says he wishes those fighting over the debt ceiling and spending would understand both of those things. And with that, Reynolds heads off, paperwork in hand, to the college's career counseling office. Don Gagne, NPR News.
Here's another reason to fish the plastic out of your wallet. The back-to-school shopping season has officially begun, or at least that's what retailers want you to think. The first day of class for most students may still be a month or two away, but as NPR's Hansi Lo Wang reports, the retail industry is eager for a head start.
Ah, July, the season of beach getaways and backyard cookouts. Well, how did that old Staples commercial describe it?
It's the most wonderful time of the year.
It's that time of year again.
It's back to school time at Staples.
And at almost every other retail store out there. Just walk into a nearby Target and you'll be greeted by banners spelling out back to school next to photos of shiny new school supplies and smiling children. Some parents, like Felicia Powers of Columbia, Maryland, say it's too soon.
I resent the signs up now. Summer just started, like kids have their summer.
But for retailers, it's never too early to start cashing in on the second most lucrative shopping season of the year.
For Staples, back to school is almost like Christmas.
Jevin Eagle is in charge of merchandising and marketing for Staples. The office supply chain recently offered packs of pens and erasers for as low as pennies to entice early bird shoppers.
The economy is not as good as we would all like it to be. There are a lot of people out of work, and we really want to have great hot deals for everyone.
Consumers and parents don't feel very optimistic about the future.
Chris Christopher is an economist with IHS Global Insight. He says recent dips in consumer confidence mean shoppers will be more tentative about their purchases. June's dismal jobs report also dampens the outlook for this year's back-to-school sales. Last month, falling gas prices and aggressive discounting did bring in more business for department clothing and discount stores. But Christopher says retailers should expect only a modest bump from back-to-school sales by the end of the summer. By the way, the end of the summer no longer means the end of back-to-school shopping.
The back-to-school season is very close to the holiday season. And what might happen is there'll still be some back-to-school shopping in October and November.
And that means retailers have to be ready for back-to-school shoppers even after the first school bell rings. Pam Goodfellow is a Consumer Insights Director for Big Research. She says in this economy, more families are taking their time to prowl through store aisles and online before striking with a purchase.
So if a sale on notebooks this week doesn't look so great, they're going to pass it up and they're going to wait and they're going to wait.
Some shoppers wait for sales tax holidays in states like Missouri, Texas, and Virginia, when clothing and school supplies are exempt from sales tax. But 9-year-old Jacob Haywood can't wait.
Mom, do we have enough pens at home? Do we have enough pens at home?
Jacob and his mother, Ari, stop by a Target just to pick up some snacks for a family road trip to Virginia. But they couldn't resist checking out the new displays of composition notebooks and pencil grips.
Well, I'm trying to convince my son to kind of hold off and get the best deals, but we're both so excited we can't stop ourselves. It's ridiculous.
Before long, Jacob flashes a toothy smile to convince his mother to add a few extra items to their shopping cart, including a $9 pencil box.
And I got an $80 backpack.
That's true. He has an LL Bean backpack that he loves, and was kind of pricey, but again, for school, anything for school.
That's music to the ears of retailers who will be listening for more signs of consumer confidence. Hansi Lo Wang, NPR News.
This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer. NASA's final shuttle mission ends this week. The last flight of the Shuttle Atlantis marks the end of the U.S. shuttle program. Earlier this month, Weekend Edition's Audie Cornish explained to us what the end of that program means for NASA's astronaut corps. This week, she's back to talk about the next phase of space exploration, commercial space travel. Hello, Adi.
Hey there, Linda.
So what does NASA think about private companies getting into the space biz?
NASA doesn't really have a choice in the matter because President Obama has decided that the future of space travel will be taken up by private industry, that essentially the grunt work of getting to the space station and just kind of bringing things up there should be done by private industries. And we won't have any sort of shuttle of our own to go up there. And we'll be paying Russia for rides on their space vehicles if we want our astronauts to get to the International Space Station.
So what are the companies that are jumping into this opportunity?
Well, first and foremost, you've got defense contractors like Boeing. You've also got aerospace contractors, companies like SpaceX, which was founded by or co-founded by one of the founders of PayPal, who's just interested in the private space industry. And we also looked around for sort of large-scale projects, and we hit upon Spaceport America, which is actually in your home state of New Mexico.
I envy you that trip to New Mexico. I try to keep other people out of the state. Obviously,
it's beautiful. I can understand why. And Spaceport is interesting because it's essentially an airport for spaceships. The state is taking on building this. And the goal is to design something that contractors who are trying to build the next big thing to replace the shuttle will want to do it there in New Mexico. And also, it's going to be a hub for space tourism. So, again, that totally sinks your plan of having fewer people go to the stage. So we set out on the road to the future of commercial space travel, which, according to the people behind Spaceport America, begins in the tiny town of Truth or Consequences. And it was just outside the town when we noticed these little yellow stickers that they were in the shape of a rocket. And they were stuck to all the highway signs along the route.
It's kind of a mystery. We don't know who's putting those there.
Really?
Yeah.
It's not Spaceport?
No, it's not the state.
That's David Wilson. He's a spokesman for the state of New Mexico's Spaceport Authority. He took us on a 45-minute drive deep into the desert. On the horizon, there were miles of spiky grasses and the occasional bison. The sky above was powder blue and clear of clouds. For decades, it's been the perfect place for pioneering rocket scientists.
But Robert Goddard brought his experiments and his rockets to the New Mexico deserts in the 30s for the same reasons. There's this incredible weather window. There's no population out here. And then you're a mile up from sea level. We have a saying around here, the first mile of space is free. It takes less energy to get to space from a place out here like this. So.
Plus, they don't have to worry about planes. The airspace is restricted thanks to the nearby White Sands military installation. The first thing you see when you pull up to the spaceport construction site is a sign that says it will be finished in early 2011. The project is running behind schedule and over budget for a number of reasons. There isn't enough water, so they have to truck some in. There's no power, so they have to use generators until they can build a power station. Just one of the two highway routes is even paved. You can see the beginnings of a 100,000-square-foot terminal rising like a turtle shell out of the dirt and sand. Lots and lots of sand. But Christine Anderson sees more.
I see a lot of tourists coming through here. We'll have a really fantastic visitors complex. We also see some other venues. This is a fantastic place to enjoy the Southwest if they want to do nature hikes. Maybe we'll even have an art gallery of New Mexico and art in our visitors experience. So that's what I see. I see a hub of activity and excitement and interest.
Anderson is the head of the state's Spaceport Authority. She was appointed by the new Republican governor, who replaced several board members and called for audits of the authority's spending. The state has already poured in $200 million into financing Spaceport, much of that approved back in 2007, when New Mexico was flush with a $500 million surplus. This year, the state expects a $450 million deficit. Now the governor wants the private sector to pick up the tab for Spaceport when state financing winds down in 2013. It's Anderson's job to get more businesses to take up residence in the Spaceport so it will eventually pay for itself.
And our anchor tenant is Virgin Galactic. So we already have one very strong customer coming to the Spaceport. And with the ramping down, of course, of shuttle, and also the tight budgets in the military side of space. So I think it's we're here at the right time and in the right place.
Now, essentially, this is going to be tourism is your anchor tenant. I have heard some people sort of say this is sort of an expensive carnival ride, you know, that we're sort of staking our job creation and all this stuff on hoping that wealthy people will want to get 5 minutes in space. What's your response to that?
Well, that's the space tourism part. So those are the actual six passengers that get to ride in the, you know, the spaceship of Virgin Galactic. But, you know, we're going to have a lot of interesting other things that have to do with space. And I think people will be very excited about that.
Of course, not everybody is excited.
Karen Perez, Doñana County Commissioner, District 3.
Karen Perez works for one of the two counties to vote in new taxes for the project. 25 cents on every $100 in sales. Altogether, Doña Ana citizens are investing $50 million in Spaceport. The commissioner says she was new on the job when state officials came around making their pitch.
You're going to see all kinds of side jobs that come in or ancillary industry that's associated with the spaceport. And we said, really, what's that going to be? Well, payloads and electronics places and people to work on the motors. And then we'll see during the construction, we'll see local construction, we'll see construction jobs. Afterwards, we'll see local jobs. And really what it came down to afterwards is there's maintenance jobs, and they'll hire people locally to do janitorial work.
Perez says local construction firms were outbid by larger outfits, some from out of state. Meanwhile, the road to the spaceport from Las Cruces in Doña Ana County is still unpaved. Commissioner Perez says the county is physically and economically cut off from Spaceport, at least for now.
I think one of my biggest regrets is allowing ourselves to be rushed into an election, because a lot of the information, it was very, very glamorous and very exciting, and there was a lot of promises on jobs, again, for construction. It was the very beginning of the recession, and people were worried about how they were going to survive. And this looked like it was going to give us some sort of immediate return on our investment. We're still waiting to see a return.
But companies aren't wasting any time selling the dream of private space travel. One of the best known is Virgin Galactic, the private space tourism company owned by British business tycoon Richard Branson.
This will be a trip like no other. Will give those that travel with us a unique and life-changing perspective of our planet.
Within 10 seconds, they're traveling supersonic, and within about 30 seconds, they're going almost 3.5 times the speed of sound.
That's Carolyn Windsor, the company's head of astronaut sales. She says more than 400 people have already signed up for the ride.
So instantly when the rocket motor ignites, they'll be pushed back into their seat with quite high G-forces, and there'll be all this noise with the rocket motor right behind you. And they'll do that for around 90 seconds, right up and out of the atmosphere vertically. And very, very quickly, the sky will change color from blue through to dark blue and eventually into black. So then the rocket motor shuts off, and instantly it's completely silent, and instantly they're weightless. And at that point, they can unfasten their seat belts, and they can float out of their seats and spend about 4 minutes floating around the cabin, enjoying that sensation of weightlessness.
Apparently, that sensation is worth $200,000 a ticket. Windsor took us on a tour inside the half-finished terminal for space tourists. And there's more than that going on at Spaceport. They're getting a license for a vertical launch pad as well as a horizontal runway. That could open the door to research and space trips beyond Earth's orbit. Windsor argues that turning a profit with space tourism is an important part of the plan to boost the entire private industry.
NASA has done a fabulous job, and they will continue to do so, but it's difficult for them. They've got a limited budget and the whole universe literally to explore. And so I think it's absolutely right that they be left to focus on things further afield, deep space, lunar exploration, whilst the private sector focuses on the near-Earth stuff. And I think that what happens in the private sector is if we can show that it's profitable to be in the space business, it will attract more investment and it will enable us to more quickly develop better technology. Once you prove a concept, once you prove you can make money out of it, it attracts more money and the technology improves as well.
As Windsor ducks under construction lights and steps over piles of metal and wood, she points out the future spot of mission control. She tells us how all five Virgin shuttles will fit in the gaping space of the spaceport hangar below. What she can't tell us is when the first rocket load of ticket holders will take off. For Weekend Edition, I'm Audie Cornish.
You're listening to NPR News. This is Weekend Edition from NPR News. I'm Linda Wertheimer. The United States plays Japan this afternoon for the Women's World Cup Championship. The U.S. team has attained the top ranking in the world, but it still remains in the shadow of the team that won the championship in 1999. And as thrilling as the ride has been so far in this tournament, the players know that a great journey deserves a great ending. From Frankfurt, Germany, NPR's Mike Pesca reports.
A short while before this tournament began, U.S. striker Abby Wambach was asked what it takes to win the World Cup. Wambach is the right person to ask because she combines experience with a certain indomitability.
What is it going to take? It's going to take some guts. It's going to take some luck. It's going to take some skill, some goals, some defending.
Let's take them one by one. Guts. Well, what else can you say of the USA's quarterfinals victory against Brazil? The Americans were down a player after being assessed a tough red card. They were down a goal after a very tough penalty re-kick. They were down to a minute or two in playing time left. But they were never down on themselves.
Now, USA have it. And they've just got to get everybody forward now. No sense defending anymore. Lloyd's got to get this pass off to Rapinoe. And everybody's got to bomb forward now. Rapinoe gets a crossing. It's towards Wombat. Oh, can you believe this? Abby Wombat has saved the USA's life.
The call from ESPN's Ian Dark. The second trait Wombat listed was luck, the shifty-eyed cousin of the amazing comeback. For all the thrills, it's important to note that over their last three games, the U.S. has actually lost in a non-elimination game, staged that amazing comeback you just heard, and let France score an equalizing goal in the second half. Bluntly, the U.S. has shown its weaknesses. Christy Rampone, the only member of the current team to have played on the 1999 squad, the last to win a World Cup, talked about the team's biggest problem after their win against France.
We've been coming out a little slow in the second half, which we'll have to fix for the final, but amazing, once again, battle back.
The U.S. was likely exhausted during that game, the effect of having played so much extra time a player down against the Brazilians. That shouldn't be a factor in the finals. Also, against the Japanese, the U.S. should own the air. The 5'11"-inch Wambach will face no defender taller than 5'7". That addresses Wambach's pre-tournament list that included goals. The defense, also on the list, will be anchored by Hope Solo, arguably the best goalkeeper in the world. The last thing on Wambach's list was skill, and that has been the key for the U.S. The team's skill extends beyond soccer ability. Their real skill has been of the mental variety. They embrace their role as champions of a sport and champions for a gender. They're always asked, what does your success mean for soccer, and specifically for girls' soccer? Members of the Green Bay Packers or Miami Heat don't have to answer questions of that type. But the U.S. women never fall back on the pre-programmed athlete ease of, we can't worry about that, or we're just focused on winning. A big reason for this mindset is their coach, Pia Sundhage, who knows how to keep all the pressures and directives in harmony.
It's funny, this life, it's about a lot of pressure, a lot of stress, and of course the players feel the same thing. Then I just tell them, slow down, you move too fast. You got to make the morning last, yes, kicking down the cobblestone, looking for fun and feeling groovy.
So let's draw some inspiration from the Paul Simon loving coach and note that it's still crazy after all these years to think that the U.S. women's team is without vulnerabilities. But if they play their game, the World Cup trophy could very well be homeward bound. Mike Pesca, NPR News, Frankfurt, Germany.